collecting the job, I always hesitate to choose something or do something. Is istikhara the only way to know if a certain particular thing that I am going to do or choose is good for me, or there is another way? What Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has guided us to do is not to start with istikhara. Firstly, we need to know that we don't know what's going to happen in the future. And we're not the ones that decide that. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala puts us in specific circumstances. We've got to make the right choices in them. The right choices are the responsibility that we have. Other than that, doesn't really make a difference. Doesn't really make a difference. Now, we try with our wisdom to try the guideline that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given us to make decisions, is that He's provided us with an intellect, with a means of understanding and comprehending, to assist or assess the situation, see in that situation what is the best decision to make. Choosing a field is one of them, choosing a job is another one. The guidelines in choosing the job, obviously we've got to make sure it's not haram. Then the job, amongst the things that are halal, we want to choose, we don't know which one's going to be good. Which one's going to be good, or what field we're going to study in, I think there's a lot of reasons why you would wonder which one you can do better in, which one there's going to be more money in it. Well, obviously we're going to be doing, trying to do our own research, come to a conclusion, what I like, what is best for me. I try to weigh that. If I can't come to a conclusion, the advice that we have is to consult others, to speak to others that have more experience, to know what the situation is, and see if you can come to a decision after having talked to them. If I can't come to a conclusion, that's the time for istikhara. Okay? And istikhara, okay, let's not misunderstand. Istikhara doesn't tell us what the future is. Istikhara does not tell us if this that we are doing is going to go the way we wanted it to. So if my intention is I'm trying to find the best job that can make the most money, and I can't make up my mind, I make an istikhara on a particular one, it turns out good, that doesn't mean that that job is necessarily going to give you more money compared to something else. Istikhara is consulting with Allah, and He tells you what is best for you, the way He sees it, what is actually best for you, not necessarily the way you see it, what you think is best for you. So, when we do make an istikhara, in the cases that we are advised to do istikhara, or we can do that istikhara, the result of it, again, is not about the future, what's going to happen with that. You're actually going to get to what you're trying to get to in terms of money and things like that. That's not necessarily going to be the truth. It's only going to give you an answer as to whether this action is good for you or it's not, the way Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala sees it, not the way we are intending, what we are intending from that activity. Any follow up questions or any other questions?
But it still sounds sometimes crazy, you know, because you put a lot of time on researching and you're not coming anywhere. It's just very hard. In the case of when you choose a field.
In that case too, I mean, if you wish to do an istikhara, that is a case that one can do istikhara. If they've done their research, they haven't come to a conclusion, they can do an istikhara if they wish and act according to that.
Can you talk just generally about the types of istikhara that we've got that are supported by hadiths and generally accepted?
The question is about types of istikhara that we have in hadith and generally accepted. The word istikhara, actually, if we look at it in hadith, we don't find it too much in the form that we do istikhara these days. Okay. Istikhara literally means talab al khayr, okay? Asking and seeking good. It's mostly used in the hadith about when one wants to do something, they've already decided what they want to do, they want to engage in it, At the beginning, do istikhara. In other words, talab al khayr, that I want Allah, I ask, please make what I'm about to do, make good come out of it, make it beneficial, the best that can come out of it. There's prayers, there's du'as for istikhara in that sense of it. Then we have the istikhara that we talk about, which is actually asking help to make a decision before actually doing it. I don't even know which one I'm going to do. I have option to do this or not to do it, or to, amongst a few things, which one to do. I want to decide what to do there. Then we have the concept of istikhara there. But the word istikhara, we don't find it too much in the hadith in this, if at all. I would have to refresh my mind, but if it is found at all being used in this context, it's very little. The word that was used a little more was qura'a, okay, which I think in one of the question and answer sessions we had a little bit about that, the concept of qura'a, where it's like lottery, you know, you put a few writings, papers, you write yes or no or this, whatever it is that you're wondering what to do with that, and you put it on your pillow or in a box or something, you just, without knowing, just pick one of them out, and whatever the answer is, that's what you're going to do. In that, what we have in our hadith regarding this istikhara, that is actually mentioned. The one about both using the Quran and tasbih, which I don't even know if they had tasbih like this that we have these days, but that's not mentioned in the hadith. It's the concept of Quran. What you use with Quran is different things that you could use. One of them is the Quran, one of them is this. The way you do it, again, there's a lot of different. Each scholar has adapted to their own particular method of doing.
So, basically, it's true to understand then that, to conclude that the Imams didn't really use Quran to istikhara.
I haven't read anywhere that they did.
There is this, I think, there's two rukavit, Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
That's the istikhara, the question is about the two rak'ahs that Imam Hussein recited and prayed. That's the istikhara in the sense of talab al khayr, asking for good, not istikhara the way we do it.
In your laptop, you can have you know, Quran recitation going on very like low volume, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you're paying attention to it. It's like just generally, it's just going on. You're perhaps studying, or you're out cooking, or something like that. But you're just doing it because you want to have this, you know, aura, if I can say, of Quran. And then sometimes when you're sitting, you can't pay attention to it. Is that considered disrespect to Quran to not to ignore it in such a way, or can you actually?
Okay, the question is putting on Quran like on the computer or in the house, and it's low volume, and I'm doing with my regular activities, and I'm not really paying attention to it. But just to have that on in the house, and then sometimes paying attention to it, what is the, is that disrespect or not? Well, if it is disrespect, being disrespect or not, it's not something that we are told. I don't think there's any hadith like that. If someone would be like, just picking out the Quran without paying attention to it, without paying proper respect, would just be reading through it, that may be something that is mentioned in the hadith, but that this mention in the hadith, we don't have anything like that at those times. So, if it is considered disrespect according to the common view of the Quran, then you can't put on it, it would be haram. If it's not disrespect, it's jaiz, it's allowed, one can do that. We do have in hadith that Quran is recited in a house, and the angels see that and all of that, but I'm not sure if it would apply to this type of recitation, or it more refers to an individual, a human being, reciting that and the effects of that. I've seen in Qom, even some of the offices of Maraja, in some rooms maybe, I think I remember them doing that. So there are people that do that. I don't see how it's considered disrespect.
So, I mean, there's a verse in the Quran that says, وَإِذَا قُرِئَ الْقُرْآنُ فَاسْتَمِعُوا لَهُ وَأَنصِتُوا. Does it not apply
in
this?
It's not wajib.
Sheikh, you mentioned even about Quran. It's something that Allah Sallam turned out to be. For example, if you say that I'm going to play a lottery, okay, but I don't know about my destiny, I'm going to a particular shop and buy a lottery, that it's not meant to be that I should buy just that one. I buy it, and then I win $1 million. So is this kind of Qura is in the hand of God, or just happened just like that? Or it meant to be that I should win that?
Okay, the question is about, you know, since we mentioned the concept of lottery, not the concept of Qura we talked about, but we mentioned that the English word we used was lottery. The brother's asking that if somebody goes and buys lottery, or who wins in the lottery, let me put it in that word, in those words, is that in the hands of Allah, or is it just happening random? Everything that happens in this universe is under Allah's control. There's nothing that happens accidentally compared to Him. For us, a lot of things are accidental without us knowing or intending it, it happened. Okay. But for Allah, Allah knows it beforehand, and He wills it, and it happens. So, yeah, He knows who's going to win, how He wins, and all that, all those under His control.
Yeah, but I see that a lot of people, I mean, we say that here in Sweden, Swedish, they are playing and they win a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't win because I don't play, because as far as this kind of lottery is concerned, I think it's haram.
Yes, it is haram. Lottery is haram.
So if I don't do anything, so I won't win. But they
do it, and
they win.
Yeah.
So it's still because even the person who was played, he didn't know that he's going to win, but he wins.
Yeah. He didn't know he's going to win. Somebody's going to win there, right? They're going to give that all that
random
money to somebody. It's random. It's random for us. We don't know. God knows.
Yes, of course God knows, but that winning lot is supposed to be won by that person, or just happened like...
It was supposed
it was,
to
it was written for his destiny that this person should win lottery.
No, don't use the word, it was written for his destiny, okay? A destiny that's previously made for an individual. The aspect of what happens to us, not our own activities, okay, how much money comes to me, yes, that is something that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has, gives us. Even when you work, as we said, I don't know if it was the second or third session, it's Allah that provides, that gives you. We think we know how much you're going to get, but we actually, in reality, we don't. It's just because we've gotten that before, we're expecting that next month, we're expecting the same expenses that we've gotten used to, but so all of a sudden there's an accident. All of a sudden I lose my job, all of a sudden this or that. That's, Allah knows that that's what's going to happen. You're put in that situation, what are you going to do with that situation is the important thing.
But I was saying that in case lottery, it was, you said, predestined.
God knows who's going to win.
Okay, so it means that that person must play to win, because it's
no.
Already decided.
See, you're getting into the discussion of destiny and free will and all of that. Just because God knows who's going to do it, that doesn't mean that person has to do it for that knowledge to come true. God knows who's going to do it, and He knows who's going to win. It's not because He knows that that person is going to have to win.
That He must win to give the money.
He has. He will. He will do that. He doesn't have to. He will do it. Yes.
Didn't participate.
Yes, you participating in it is not allowed. But if some kafla comes and gives it to you for whatever reason,
what about if my kafla friend buys another?
You didn't do it.
Okay.
She did. He did.
Pay tax.
What is that?
You should pay tax.
Sorry, so if you would, if you request from your kafir friend to buy a lottery for you,
don't be like Bani Israel. Another thing, if you ask your kafir friend to buy it for you, I can't order them to do something that's it's not allowed. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, it's not a question.
Okay. I don't know exactly which.
Can you repeat the question?
The question. The question is about nadr, and usually when we talk about nadr, we say if such and such happens, I'll do something, like I'll give food on Ashura, or I'll give iftar, or I'll do this, or I'll do that, 100 salawat, things like that. But this one of the sister's friends is making another that for the next year I will not have any sweets if I do such and such. If I understand correctly, if she does something wrong, for example, she's not going to have any sweets, or?
No, it's just something happens. I thought that's not really what she
uh-huh. Well, firstly, the nadr, the biggest condition, okay, the main condition for a nadr to be a valid nadr, okay, is that what we pledge with Allah to do has got to be something good. Okay. If it's something useless, or something that's not really clearly good, okay, or worse than that, if it's harmful, then that nadr is not valid. I would think it's either harmful, if the nadr is all sweets are put aside, that may even be harmful. Okay. Yeah, I think that I wouldn't classify that as something useful. Useful to, if you want to do nadr, do something useful. Help somebody, pray something, salawat, something good. Herself, somebody else, yes. I personally wouldn't, yeah. The rule is that, this is my judgment. My judgment is that, you know, I don't see what the purpose of that. If it's something like, even good for the health, to say, for example, if this happens, I won't drink any fizzy drinks, as the British say. Okay, if I don't, well, that's good, because if there's, if you stay away from that, it's good for you. If you say sweets altogether, staying away from that altogether isn't, eating sweets is not harmful. To say, oh, well, staying away from it is something useful. If you have a regular diet and have some sweets, that's not problematic. So making a pledge that I won't have this at all, it's not one that's useful. I don't.
Anything that is like obvious will kind of harm your body. Is that something that's haram? I mean, bearing in mind general ruling that, for instance, if you don't do sports when you've got heart kind of conditions, that's bad. If you eat sugar when you've got diabetes, that's bad.
Anything, the ruling is anything that has substantial harm.
What is that with substantial harm?
Substantial harm is substantial harm. And cancer is substantial harm. Diabetes is substantial harm. Losing a limb, or losing a hand, or these types of diseases, it's substantial harm. Okay. Even if it's in the long run, but you know if you continue this diet, for example, it's going to lead to that. Or if you get, for example, one thing that was mentioned about like smoking, if you start it, you're going to get addicted and you will end up smoking it to the extent that it's going to be harmful for you, because one or two cigarettes is not going to cause you that. But if you know, if you start, you're going to end up getting there. It's haram to begin in the first place. Okay. So anything that leads to substantial harm. What is substantial harm? What is exactly substantial harm? Something that, you know, is a common understanding of it. That if you would want to bring that harm to yourself, you would be like, are you stupid? Why do you want to do that? Otherwise, a little small harm, that's not something that's harmful. It's better, obviously, to stay away from that, but a little bit of harm, anything. You have a little bit extra oil in one meal, it has a little bit of harm. That's not something. You have chips or crisps, whatever you guys call them, you're going to have a little bit of harm, but that's not something that's haram.
Because I wanted to come to this issue of latam at the field.
Okay.
Because, as you mentioned earlier as well, the ulama, they're not agreeing on what is the substantial harm there, because some people say it's not harmful, some people say it's harmful. How can I, as a Shia,
the scholars that have talked about tatmir, okay, blood not on the chains or the swords or whatever, I didn't see the ones that I checked, at least none of them have talked about substantial harm, because it's the ones that they've seen, at least, or know of. They haven't seen that to be substantial harm. The regular cuts, and bleeding itself is not the substantial harm.
Right.
What they talk about is the damage of the image of the sky. Yes? Goes back to the law of copyright. Okay. If it's a law that you have to abide by. The general ruling is you have to abide by the laws of the country you're living in. Okay. There's a law called copyright. Forget about what the book says on it. That's not a law. Whatever the law is, you have to abide by that. If the law says you can't even make photocopies of some of those pages, then you can't do that. As far as I know, that's not part of the law. You can make photocopies. At least in the U.S.
it's not allowed.
Hmm?
It's not allowed.
It's not allowed here? You can't make photocopies of the pages?
No. Actually, you mentioned that that was the ruling of Sayyid Sistani. Is that the ruling of is it a sin?
When something is Islamically your responsibility, if you don't do it, it's a sin, isn't it?
So speeding is a sin?
Speeding going against that law. That's what it says, you know, that's what that means. Okay.
I mean, then all the Muslims.
All the Muslims are committing a lot of other sins too. Just breaking the laws.
Concerning alcohol, is that najis or not?
The substance alcohol, the question is about alcohol being najis or not. The substance alcohol is not, according to Al-Sistani, it is not in and of itself najis. Intoxicating beverages are not just wine, champagne, liquor, beer, these things are najis. But the substance alcohol itself is not najis. So if you have alcohol that's derived from whatever source, not from these things, and it's added to a drink or to vanilla extract, for example, it's not going to be najis. But alcohol itself, other than najasa, it's harmful too. So if you have a spoon of alcohol, that's going to cause a lot of harm. It's pure alcohol. So because of the harm, it's haram, but it's not najis. Okay. But if you have a little bit of it, it doesn't have that harm either. So it's neither najis nor haram. And since it's not najis, it doesn't make the entire liquid najis. And therefore, you can take it like vanilla extract is liquid form. It has alcohol in it. It's less than 2%. And therefore, it's not najis, that substance or that liquid vanilla extract. It's not haram.
You know the intoxicating beverages, if you get some on your clothes or something, would you be able to pray or?
Intoxicating beverages, if you get it on your clothes, of course you can't pray, it's not just.
But what happens if a doctor tell you to drink alcohol or eat something haram?
Drink alcohol? I don't think.
I mean,
something that has alcohol in it, I think the more.
There's a lot of medicine that have.
They have alcohol in it.
I've heard that some doctors has emphasized their patients to drink alcohol because of their kidneys to purify it somewhat.
What you mean, like
I mean
liquor,
beer
and stuff like that? No, if they, that's not right. The Holy Quran tells us about intoxicating beverages. Allah Subhanahu wa Taala says in the Quran that it doesn't. It's not like it doesn't have any benefit. Fihi manafi'u linnas. It has some benefits, but the harm in it overweighs the benefit of it. So it's haram. It's not. Can't listen to the advice of the doctor. Drink beer because it purifies your liver.
Because if I would be as a patient and I don't have any option because the doctor says that you must do this one, otherwise you know, survive.
No, that's not a medication. If, I mean, something like that, obviously, but there's some medicine that has alcohol in it. The ruling that that has is the same thing that we said about vanilla extract and stuff. I have to look into that. Then there's other medication that has other forms of haram in it. For example, gelatin has haram gelatin in it. In that case, if that's the only medication, then one needs to take it to stay away from substantial harm, have a serious disease or something that requires that, then taking the medication is going to be okay. But the doctor is saying that you need to drink beer or wine. That's not something to listen to. Yes? Alcohol itself, according to Al-Sistani, is not najis. So if you add that to a liquid, it doesn't make it najis. So the only reason why it would be haram is because of the harm in it. So since it's medication and it's not harmful, you can take it according to Atlas Islam. That's pretty clear. Atlas Khamenei Sahib, however, is a little different. He says, any intoxicating liquid that is originally liquid, not that it was an intoxicating solid that was turned into a liquid. Okay. The form that it has, intoxication, the effect of intoxication, what is the original form of that? Is it solid? Not what it's taken from, because obviously a lot of the alcohol is taken from solids, even the wine that they used to make from dates, the Arabs used to. Okay. Well, dates are not liquid. When you make that liquid, the first stage of it, whatever you're making, the first stage of it being intoxicated, if it's a liquid, okay, according to Abu Hamid, that is najas. But if it's not liquid, and it's turned liquid, for example, then that's not going to be najas. And if we're doubtful, it's still not considered najas. So it won't make it najas. That's in medication. first question, are you obligated to tell people about tell people about Islamic rulings. For example, if you see a person doing something wrong, tell them, even if you think that that person will not follow that. Do we have to tell them? The concept of amru bil ma'ruf wa nahi 'anil munkar. If we see someone doing something that's wrong, or not doing something that they're supposed to, they're either missing a wajib or doing something that's haram, we're obligated to tell them. The only exception is that if we know that they're not going to listen, not that. There's a good chance, 80% they're not going to listen. Well, 20% they're going to listen. You still have to tell them. But if you're sure it's not going to have any effect, then you don't have to.
Is that applicable to non-Muslims also?
To Muslims, obviously. To non-Muslims, certain things, yeah, when it comes, it becomes a social crime, social disease that is developing, even amongst, even they realize it's wrong. One example may already be too late, but homosexuality, for example, you gotta speak out against that so it doesn't become, I mean, God has punished nations before when the majority of them, the vast majority of them have become like that. Okay, so if the vast majority of the country you're living in becomes homosexual, then Lord have mercy on us. So you gotta do something to stop that. Second question, if you do istikhara, are you obligated to follow the outcome? We don't have anything called that says it's wajib to follow what the istikhara says, but you're asking Allah for help and He tells you what to do and you don't want to listen to that. That's not respectful. And what the teachers say in that regard is that after that, if you make an istikhara, it may not turn out, or the answer of it may not actually be what you're looking for, because once you were given the answer, you didn't want to act according to it. Next time, you're not going to get the right answer. That's the effect of it that has been mentioned.
Hussein wonders if it's okay to. Is it okay to chew on the nails during fasting?
Chewing on the nails. If you don't swallow it, which I hope you don't, it's not problematic.
But is it not makruh to do it?
I haven't seen that. It's makruh generally for fasting. I mean, generally speaking, chewing on your nails is makruh. Putting your beard in your mouth is makruh. Some people like to. You don't have a long beard, you don't have to worry about it, for those who do.
Sheikh, you know, bearing in mind that our imams and masumin in general, they tend to keep a long hair.
I would have to disagree right there. So, right. Brother is saying, keeping in mind that masumin used to keep long hair. Who says that? No, they didn't always keep long hair. Sometimes it was long, sometimes it was short.
But they did have long hair.
Sometimes, yes.
Keeping that in mind.
Okay.
What do you think about, because there is a negative view in today's, culture.
Well, back in the old days, it wasn't negative. Now, there is a negative impression. It's associated with certain things. If you have long hair, especially if you keep it a certain way, then it's associated with a lot of other things too, so. Because of that, it could be considered libas al-shuhra. Okay, a dressing that would be considering you, according to Ayatollah Sistani, libas al-shuhra is something that puts you down. Okay, you're viewed as a something that, you know, people wouldn't want to be around.
But if you take that in mind, then, you know, beard in this country is still regarded as, you know, like the look of the terrorist and the, you know, the close-minded people. Would that be?
That's something that Islam has said you have to do. That's amongst the halal clothing that you're wearing. Okay, you shouldn't wear something like dress in an ugly way. Okay, wear raggedy clothes all over the place. People say, you're not supposed to disrespect and put aside your dignity as a mu'min, as a believer. That's, of course, Ayatollah Sistani's interpretation of the Libas al-Shuhra. But anyway, I'm not trying to say that it's haram to keep long hair or anything like that. Obviously, it's not haram to keep long hair, period. Some of the styles, some of the hairstyles that have long hair, some of them may be short hair too, that depends. If there's something that's not very good, it's not associated with the right things, then obviously it's not good for a mu'min to have that.
About the beard, actually, most of the acknowledged marajas, they consider it wajib to have the beard.
Ihtiyat wajib, yes.
Ihtiyat wajib, okay, but, if...
Of course, they don't. Not all of them say you need to keep a full beard.
But you can't shave on the chins, that's, like, you can't...
Yeah, the ones that say you don't need to keep a full beard, what they mean is that you don't have to, you can shave that part of the ayatollah. Father Ben Kanani, that passed away, said that you can keep a goatee and shave the rest of it.
So you can't shave, okay.
According to him, yeah.
Anyway, but like most of the people are following those.
According to Ayatollah Sistani, Ayatollah Khamenei, some of the others, you don't have. I mean, you do have to keep a full beard. Of course, it's ihtiyat wajib. Ihtiyat wajib means you can go to another madrasa, to the next most knowledgeable.
No consensus, so I can't ask my question. But actually, if there were consensus among the Marajas, but there's not, because you said that,
yeah.
Even Ayatollah Fadl al-Kirani saying that it's okay with a goat. But how is it okay? What I'm asking is it okay to like sit in front of people and recite the Quran without beard because you can see it a lot, like clean shape? I mean,
Well, it's not wrong to recite the Quran if you're not doing everything exactly right. I mean,
the appearance, like, you can't...
The appearance, well, if they're following a madrasa that says that it's allowed to do that. Although, even according to those that say it's allowed, there's no question that it's sunnah to leave a beard. It's good to leave a beard. The Prophet has hadith that this is the sunnah, to leave the beard. But is it haram to shave it? There's not everybody agrees that it's haram to shave it. Yes?
They draw some more attention to them by wearing the niqab.
First of all, and obviously Islamically, the face is not something that we need to cover. There's a reason why God hasn't made that wajib to cover. And I haven't seen anywhere that it says it's mustahab to even cover that. I haven't seen anything. If you find anything. Some women used to cover their face. They used to have something to cover parts of their face, and in Hajj they're not even allowed to wear that. Okay, it's not allowed to wear that. That covers the face. Now, whether they wore it at those times to cover their face in front of the non-mahram, or what they used to do it for, it's at least questionable. But some others used to like have a bit of their scarf or something that they would let it hang on their face, so non-mahram, when they're there, they don't see it. This is what we do find in some of the ahadith. About doing that in the West, I really haven't seen the scholars discuss the topic. What I can say is that the concept of libas al-shuhra, based on whatever view is accepted, I wouldn't think it applies to that. wearing proper hijab, there's a certain level of it that is wajib, that we'd have to, more than that, is recommended. The cloth that covers the entire body obviously covers more than just a scarf and something that's worn, like a blouse, a skirt, or even pants. So it covers more than that. In that sense, it is better, but out here, is it wise to do that? Is it not? If it truly creates, let me first, before getting to this last bit, I would like to say that don't misunderstand the concept of attracting attention to, you didn't mention that in your question, but just in case some people have that, because I remember the sister was emailing me and asking me about this. When she started wearing it, they were saying that people are telling me don't wear it because it attracts more attention, and sisters are not supposed to attract attention to themselves. The attention that is talked about that we're not supposed to attract, sisters are not supposed to attract, is negative, lustful attraction. That's what is supposed to be, what we're supposed to stay away from. Of the other types of attraction, in terms of hijab, that's not something, the ahadith that talk about that, they're referring to the concept of hijab, and making sure that the men are not attracted to women. That's the type of attraction that is talked about. So, in that sense, we don't have anything against it. But is it wise to do that here or not? You have to weigh the situation, see if it's truly harming the image, if it's something that it's better to wear clothing that is not like that, or brighter colors, things like that. That's something that you would have to weigh. I don't think anyone can really tell you. I know some people that have worn it. There's some sisters that I knew since I was a kid in the U.S. and they wore it all the time. Even there was a convert sister, American, white American from Texas. She would cover everything except for her eyes. You could only see the eyes, and she would wear that everywhere. She didn't care. And there was another sister. She wouldn't cover the face, but she wore the Iranian chador, the black cloth that covers the entire body, everywhere. And they were saying that their experience wasn't that very harsh or anything like that. They had actually some people were moved in a way by seeing that. So I don't know, I would have to see what's wise to do. Another sister had her hand up too, yes? Wa alaikum as-salam. About how it happens, I mean, the general guidelines are there, okay? But application of that, this is the first time I've, what I had heard previously about the abaya and wearing that in public was usually people feel like this is someone that they don't want to get close to. Some people out of respect, some people maybe out of fear, but to feel more attracted, that's, I don't know, people have changed, I guess, I don't know. But those are the general, I mean, some people are just sick, okay, I can tell you that. So no matter what you wear something, you don't wear anything, you're gonna be they have a sick mind, a sick mentality, okay. But if it actually causes extra attraction, more than what the normal hijab, normal proper hijab with other colors and not wearing that overall piece, if it actually has that effect, then obviously, yeah, don't wear it, it's better. But if it's not like that, then you would have to see if it has the harm of people, like you said, arresting you. That's a different thing. If it has that type of harm too, don't wear it. That's not good. In America, nobody will arrest you for wearing something like that. Again, I've never heard of anyone in the US, as Europe, it's different. But I haven't heard of anyone being extra attracted to someone that's wearing the overall clothing. Yes, last question. Anywhere we live in the world, we're going to have tests, okay? We're not going to be anywhere and say, okay, here, we're not going to be approached with haram, our kids are not going to be approached with haram, they don't have to deal with it. Anywhere we are, we're going to be dealing with that, okay? It's just a matter of what type of tests, and is it easier from some perspectives or not from others, okay? So I do agree that for those who believe that if you leave Europe or America and go back to Iran or Iraq or Pakistan or wherever, or Lebanon for that matter, anywhere you go and you think you're going to be keeping your religion there much more comfortably there, I disagree with that. And I think for the kids, I know people that have left the US for that reason, gone to Iran, and their kids have actually, when they reached the age, they left Iran, they went to the US, and they acted a lot worse than people, some of the kids that were raised in the US. Okay, so for those who believe that that's an easy way out, it's not. When you go there too, you have responsibilities, you have to watch out for things. Watch out so the kids don't think what others think it's okay, because in a Muslim country, okay, a lot of the things that are done, because everybody does it and they're all Muslim, they say, oh, this is okay. Why? Since everybody else is doing it, it's okay. You gotta, it's extra work. Here, the non-Muslims do it, you can easily say, oh, they're non-Muslims. They're different. But there, the Muslims are doing it. So it's difficult to say, no, this is not Islamic. You have your tests there, you have your tests here. From some perspectives, it is easier there. Just need to know how to, you know, what type of tests they are there and how to deal with that. If you know how to deal with that there, it's better for you to be there. It's going to be more comfortable. Otherwise, here, you would have your own tests, and it may be, for some people, it may be even better to stay out here. But I don't say to anybody that for you would have to like take your kids to Iran now or to Iraq now or for wherever else. That's the way out of it. No, right here, you have to, when they're young, there's certain things that we need to do to train them so that when they get older, we won't have to. At least we've done our responsibility. And we're not responsible for what they become at the end. Okay, we are responsible for what we do. There's certain responsibilities we have. If we do that right, we fulfilled it. After all, the kids are human beings. They're free. If they wish not to follow the teachings, they have the freedom to do so. It's going to harm them. But as long as I've done what I had to do, then there's nothing more than I can do. InshaAllah. Allah.